Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome back to 3 Ideas in 30 Minutes. I want to thank our sponsors for this evening, Dr. Michael and Marilyn Fedak, in gratitude for the many weekly learning opportunities at BRS, and in honor of Stephen Ellis, Zisha Ben Shlomo Lev, on his first yahrzeit with love from the Ellis family. Mazel tov to the Ellis family on the engagement. Baruch Hashem, we were zocha to be there in Eretz Yisrael, actually a week ago tonight. And as always, our learning is an aliyah for the neshama of Esther Tila Bas Gavriel Pinchas. I gotta give the winning hot dog this week, even though there are a lot of good candidates, but I gotta give it to Moshe, my son, who's eating a brisket hot dog right now. And
hold it up for the picture.
if you give your mother nachas for nothing else, you can now told her that you were the Oscar, you were the hot dog winner on March 5th, 2026.
No one can ever say he's good for nothing.
Exactly. No one can ever say he's not a good for nothing. He's a hot dog winner. Shidduch, by the way, that would be the top of the shidduch resume. Okay. All right. Here we go. 3 ideas in 30 minutes. Idea number one comes from the Sefer Bina Le'itim, who says something that is going to blow your mind away. Okay, so we, of course, know that Moshe Rabbeinu has a mask to protect his face. Of course, he comes down from Har Sinai, Vayar, Aron, V'chol B'nei Yisrael, Es Moshe, V'ine Karan Or Panav. That Moshe's face is radiating. Now, of course, that Karan Or has been mistranslated throughout history and to understand as horns. That's the whole imagery of the Jew with the horn. Who did that? Rembrandt? One of those? Michelangelo.
Moses.
He spoke about that last week with the horns. So it wasn't a horn. It was a radiance. Vayiru migesh eselav, and the Jewish people, because of this radiance, they were afraid to approach Moshe. Ubevo Moshe levnei Hashem ledaber ito yasira samasbe ad tseiso. So when Moshe came to speak to Hashem, he removed the mask. Vayetze v'daber b'nei Yisrael es asher yitzaveh, and he comes out and he speaks to the Jewish people. V'ro b'nei Yisrael es p'nei Moshe ki karan or p'nei Moshe. The Jewish people come, they see that he's radiant. Veheshiv Moshe et amatzveh panav, and Moshe Rabbeinu then puts the mask back on his face, ad bo ledaber ito, until the next time that they're going to come speak to him. So what was the purpose of this mask? So everyone thinks the purpose of the mask is to protect the Jewish people from the glow. That Moshe Rabbeinu had this shining, bright light emanating from his face, and the only way to protect yourself from that was if Moshe kind of put a lampshade on it. If he put a mask on his face, it would not overwhelm people with the glow of Moshe Rabbeinu. But ask the Sefer Bina Le'itim. He says that is not what the Pesukim say.
Who's that?
I don't know. Oh, okay. I mean, he has it on the bottom. I don't know who that is. Right? But he writes the following. He says it is not what the mask is about. Because if you paid attention very carefully to the Pesukim go out of their way to mention the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he speaks to the Jewish people, takes off the mask, and he only puts on the mask when he finishes talking to the Jewish people, which is entirely counterintuitive, which is what we would have thought. We would have thought that Moshe Rabbeinu had the mask when he was talking to the Jewish people because the light was so overwhelming, and it was afterwards, when he was no longer talking to them, that he took the mask off. That is not what happens. No. He writes here, K'mozar nechshav adavar, hayim yare lageshes el Moshe mishum kirun panav, if the fact is that they were afraid of Moshe's light, why was it that when they spoke to him, when he spoke to them, he took off the mask? And it was only when he was no longer talking to them that he put the mask on his face. So you understand what he did? We understood the Pesukim entirely incorrect. I bet you if you stop 9.5 out of 10 people on the street, and you say, why did they need the mask on the head? They would say it's because the light was overwhelming, the light was too bright, and so they needed to mask it, and so therefore he puts a mask on his face. Says the Bina Le'itim, that's not what happens. When he was talking to the Jewish people, the mask is off. It's only when he stops talking to the Jewish people that he puts the mask on. That is entirely counterintuitive and doesn't make sense with the way that we understood the Pesukim. And so therefore he writes on page number 2 something that I think is really unbelievable and beautiful. He writes in the second paragraph, We know that the first time you experience something miraculous or something awe-inspiring, so it makes a big impact on you. The first time you see something that's shocking, So it's literally going to do that to you. It's going to shock you. It's going to inspire you. It's going to wow you. But the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, the 20th time you see that, what at one point was surprising and amazing, all of a sudden it's no news. It's background noise at that point. Okay, you would imagine that the first time someone turned on a light and there was electricity. You would imagine the first time someone sent an email. You would imagine, I remember, you know, we used to go on vacations. So my father had to carry a big fax machine with us everywhere we went so that the hospital could get in touch with him. And literally, in our car, we had a big fax machine. And then I remember the cell phones. We'd be in like the middle of Canada and he'd be hanging his head out the window. Like, remember those like the antennas coming up, trying to grab it. So I would imagine the first time someone opened up a cell phone, it was like, now we don't even think twice about it. Right? So the first time something happens, it's amazing. It's a miracle. Second, third, fourth, fifth, by the 20th time, it's background noise at that point. It no longer means anything to you. He says that is exactly what's happening in our story right here. Moshe Rabbeinu understood that if he walked around day and night with a Karan Or, with this beaming light emanating from his face, so it would no longer inspire the Jewish people. It would no longer create any impact on the Jewish people. It wouldn't have an effect on them whatsoever. And so he says to himself, I need a way so that they're not exposed to the light emanating from my face 24/7. Now, he wants it when he's speaking to them, the same way he wants it when he's speaking to Hashem, because it should have that awe and it should inspire them and they should feel that it's miraculous. But if they see it all the time, it's going to lose that effect. So what does he do? When he's walking around the camp, Moshe puts the mask on so that the people no longer see the light. And it's only when he wants to make an impact on them that he takes the mask off. And now the Jewish people say, okay, now Moshe Rabbeinu means business. Now it's something that we remember how miraculous it is. You know, it's like, picture, let's take cell phone usage for a minute. So again, every one of us, it's background noise. We don't even recognize how miraculous it is that we have literally the whole world at our fingertips. But every now and then, right? But every now and then, you forget it at home, or you lose your phone, or your connection goes, or WhatsApp's down for a day, and it's a catastrophe, and your life is—it's a disaster. Your life is in shambles. You can't even function. And then when it comes back, so you appreciate it that much more. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to accomplish. If he exposed the Jewish people to the light 24 hours, you know what it's like? It's like the air conditioning right now in this room, which until I just mentioned it, no one even noticed it. I noticed it. And now you're going to notice it. It's going to drive you crazy the rest of the year, right? Because it's background noise. Now, if the AC goes on and off, then you recognize it. Then it makes an impact on you. You might get hot when it's off, then it's going to start on and you'll hear the noise. But if it's just on continuously, so the noise blends into the background. That's exactly what happens here. So let's read a little bit. He says, Zos Haisa Daito, second paragraph, Shel Moshe Rabbeinu Alav Hashalom Binyan HaMasveh. Now we understand, the third paragraph, like the bottom paragraph. Now we understand Moshe's intention when it came to the mask. Biroso ki b'nei Yisrael nivhalu mimenu birosam ki karano parnav. When Moshe Rabbeinu saw that the Jewish people were inspired by the light emanating from his face, Amar Balibo, he says in his heart, Zot yesiba nechona lashbi aleim ulahachtir balibam divrei Elokim chayim. He says this is important because this is going to strike awe in reverence into the hearts and minds of the Jewish people. The light serves a purpose. Aval, however, imat mid behofatizos, but if it's a constant light, yisraglu lekach v'tovar hashbazo, they're going to get used to it, and it's going to lose the effect and the impact that it has on them. Mishum kach sam al panav es hamasve. Therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu puts the mask on his head, bichdei shelo tamid yireh hakirun hamashpiazo, so that they don't get too used to it, so that it still will have an impact on him when he takes it off. This, of course, is a beautiful reading of the Psukim. I bet you it's like not the way any of us have read the Psukim up until this point. But you and I both know it is such a yesod in life. It comes to the Beis HaMikdash, Rav Yonas and Eibshitz. The Pasuk in Sefer Yecheskel tells us, you don't have this in your sheets, Haba derech shar tzafon lishtachavos, yetze derech shar negev. That when you went into the Beis HaMikdash, you had to go in a certain entrance, but you couldn't exit the same entrance. You had to enter and exit different doors of the Beis HaMikdash. Rav Yonas and Eibshitz says, why is that the case? Why do you have to come and go different gates? And he answers this exact same answer. He says, because if they entered and exited the same gate over and over again, you know what they would, what happened? They would get used to the Beis HaMikdash. The awe, the reverence, the sense of wonderment that they had the first time they went to the Beis HaMikdash. So if you come and go a million times, you know what the Beis HaMikdash becomes? Becomes like your living room. You're sticking your feet up. You're leaving dirt on the floor, right? It's not miraculous to you anymore. So the Pasuk in Yechezkel says that they had to enter one entrance and exit another so that it would change things up a little bit. And by changing things up a little bit, it would continue to be miraculous to you. I always ask people, you know, they have yeshivas, either yeshiva Dakot, the yeshivas just came out this week. You could all ask Moshe Moskowitz where he's going to yeshiva next year. It'll be news to me. Maybe you'll get an answer before I will. But all the yeshivas came out. So, you know, they have we were just in the old city. The yeshivas in the old city, Nativari, Hakotel, Aish. And I always ask the guys, if you spend an entire year in the old city, does the Kotel still make a make an impact on you? When you're sitting there in May, and you've been walking by the Kotel for, you know, 300 days in a row to go to Nativari, and every day you wake up, you go to the bathroom, you're overlooking the Kotel, does it still have the same impact on you? It's impossible. It's impossible to have the same impact as when we come, you know, once, twice, three, four times a year. So that's the danger. The danger is that the more you're exposed to something, it loses its majesty. It loses its ability to give yourself the sense of wonder. How do we counteract that? How do we renew that sense of newness and excitement and enthusiasm? So perhaps the answer is that's where brachos come in. Right? What's a bracha at the end of the day? A bracha is an acknowledgement that Hashem created something. But you know what really is supposed to do? It's supposed to make you stop and think for a second. This apple that you're eating, the hot dog that you're eating, the brisket that you're eating, the coleslaw, the sauerkraut, the onion rings, whatever it is. When you make that bracha on it, you're supposed to stop and say, this is not something I should be taking for granted. It's a miracle that this apple, think about how many steps need to happen for an apple to grow on a tree. How many miraculous things need to happen? Now, we're used to it, so it blends into the background of our everyday life. Brachos are supposed to jolt us out of that. So we have ways in Jewish existence. And that, if you think about it, is really one of the great challenges of modern-day religious life. Modern-day religious life, when everything is accessible and handed to us, and we're surrounded by it all the time, the challenge of religious life is to keep that sense of wonderment, to recognize that when you come into davening in the morning, that when you eat, that when you bench, that these are miraculous experiences that you get to speak to the creator of the universe three times a day. But for us, it's like we schlep into the chakras again. So this is exactly what the Bina Elitim says. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was speaking to the Jewish people, he had a mask on, but he took it off afterwards. Why? So that they would not get too used to it. That is our challenge in modern religious life, to not get too used to things, but to continue to experience the wonder and the excitement in the majesty of the world around us. That is idea number one. Idea number two comes from Rav Weinfeld. Rav Weinfeld points out that in the story of the golden calf, the Chet Eigel, which we will read about this week, so the Pasuk tells us that when the Jewish people saw that Moshe Rabbeinu was boshesh, when he was, how do you translate that? So slow, right? He was hesitant, how? Hesitant to come down the mountain. So he writes here that the word root, bet, shin, shin, appears in another context just before the sin of Eitz Hadas. As the Pasuk says, when Adam and Chava realized their nakedness, they were not ashamed. Velo yispo shashu. So it's the same root word. The Targum attributed to Yonas and Ben Uziel renders this Pasuk in a non-literal sense. And the two of them were wise, and they did not remain in their glory. Meaning, they possessed wisdom, but they did not have patience. Adam and Chava did not have patience. At that moment, when the snake came upon Chava, it infected her with a moral contamination. And when Bnei Israel stood at Har Sinai, their contamination ceased. Okay? But what's the commonality? So here you have the same root word. In our Pasuk, you have Boshesh. In the story of the Eitz Hadas, you have Lo Yisboshashu, that same word. So what's the connection? What's the connection between the story of Adam and Chava and the story of Chet Eigel? So he writes here the following beautiful idea. If you turn to page number 4. He says the following. Both the commentary of the Shach and Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, reveal that the sin of eating from the Eitz Hadas occurred in the 10th hour of the day. Meaning, had Adam and Chava waited until evening, they just had to make it just a little bit longer, it would have been permitted for them to eat the fruit. Now that's an amazing idea. It means that it wasn't that the fruit was going to be eternally prohibited to them. It means that it was prohibited to them for a certain period of time. And if only they could have passed the marshmallow test, if only they could have waited just a little bit longer and maintained self-control, they would have been scot-free and they could have eaten the fruit that they were so desiring of. In addition, Adam and Chava were seduced by the idea of becoming like angels, as the snake told Chava, "And you will be like gods." Putting these two ideas together, we can say that they suffered from both the fallacy of now or never and the fallacy of all or nothing. Meaning, they were not willing to wait, but wanted to benefit from the fruit right away, and they were not satisfied with their position as human and wanted to become more angelic. So that was the two problems of Adam and Chava. Number one is they couldn't wait. Right? We all know those children. I remember when I was younger. So Yom Kippur night, I don't remember how old I was, but I decided this was going to be, I come home from shul, Yom Kippur night, I'm starving. My mother's like, "You're not starving, you ate like an hour ago." I'm starving. I made it like 3 minutes into the fast before I think eating an ice cream sandwich, right? So Adam and Chava, they made it a little bit longer. They made it to the 10th hour, but if they just made it a little bit longer, it's like breaking your fast at, you know, 7:20 when the fast ends at 7:30. You make it a little bit longer. Make it a little bit longer. They couldn't wait. The other thing they did is they wanted to be like God. In other words, this idea that they wanted to become more angelic, and therefore it was all or nothing. And as we can't achieve perfection or perceive perfection, why bother trying at all? Says Rav Weinfeld, Bnei Yisrael suffered from these two same fallacies in the Chet Egel. They said to Aaron, "Make for us a God." When the moment they thought Moshe was to have returned had passed, they could not hold off any longer to see if he would yet return, which demonstrated their fallacy of falling for now or never. They then lost the faith in the idea of human leadership, emphasizing Moshe's mortality in stating this man Moshe and asking to be led by an angel. In other words, they believed that human leadership was not reliable, as they thought Moshe was coming back, but he disappointed them. This was the fallacy of all or nothing. If they could not have what they saw an imperfect leader, they did not want a human leader at all. They wanted nothing less than angelic leadership. This is why we find the connections between the sin of Eitz Hadas and the sin of Golden Calf. So both the story of Eitz Hadas and the story of Chet Egel have the exact same problems in both of them. In both of them, they couldn't wait. Adam and Chava just had to wait a little bit longer, and they couldn't. Adam and Chava, all they had to do were wait two more hours. They couldn't wait. And they wanted to be like God. It was all or nothing. We want the best. Jewish people at Chet Egel make the exact two same mistakes. They can't wait. They can't wait for Moshe to come down. Think about it. What would be another few hours? What was the big deal waiting for another few hours? And then, what did they need this like angelic God? Find another human being. No, the answer was that they wanted all or nothing. At this point, they said, it's got to be angelic or bust. Says Weinfeld at the end, the message to internalize is that both of these fallacies are interconnected. Understanding that it does not have to be now is an understanding that success is achieved in stages, and it also does not have to be all. One must be satisfied with steady, incremental progress. And this is something that we talk about in the Shir all the time. Number one is perfection or achieving your goals isn't going to happen overnight. You can't just snap your fingers. We live in a society where I snap my fingers and I want it now. Think about it. All the successful companies, what have they all achieved? They've all achieved instant results. So if you go on Amazon, what's the beauty about Amazon now? You click a button and 2 hours later it shows up at your door. What's the beauty of Netflix? I don't have to wait for the next episode. It automatically transitions me from one episode to the other. I don't have to wait for anything anymore. Right? We live in a society of immediate results, but it's so antithetical to religious growth. Because religious growth, by definition, cannot happen overnight. It does not happen overnight. It requires effort and toil, and sometimes two steps forward and one step back. It's not linear. It's got ups and downs and bumps along the way. It happens in stages. But what happens? What happens is we grow impatient. What happens is we grow impatient. This, I believe, doesn't just apply in our own personal lives. I think it's a lesson for Klal Yisrael in general. Klal Yisrael in general throughout history have gotten themselves in trouble when we've grown impatient with Hashem's timeline for bringing the Geula. Geula happens, what the Medrash describes as kimah kimah, little by little. It means it's not going to happen like that. It's going to happen in stages. It's going to be a progress. It's going to be incremental and steady. But you know what we need? Sometimes we need patience to stick with it, even though it's a longer process than we were hoping for. And so again, as he said, both of these sins of Chet Egel and the sins of Eitz Hadas remind us that success happens in stages and that it does not have to be all or nothing, right? We speak about it all the time. It's not perfection or bust. Growth doesn't happen that way. It could be slow and it could be incremental. It's a process. You're on a road to success, but the goal is never going to be perfection because you're never going to have arrived. That's the way Judaism happens. And so, yeah. Exactly. Couldn't wait to Shabbos. We have chulent in the lobby and hot dogs here. Okay, so we're as impulsive as the Jews were in Chet Egel. Okay, so that is idea number two. Idea number one was the beautiful idea from the Bina Leitim of the challenge to keep things fresh and new and exciting. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu taught us with his Karan Or. Idea number two came from Rav Weinfeld. The idea that we can't fall into the trap of impatience and the trap of all or nothing. We have to battle those two. Those are the two Yetzaharas, both at the Eitz Hadas and at Har Sinai. Okay. Idea number three comes from Aaron Cutler. Page number five. This is a little bit more of a circuitous idea than the ones that I normally share with you, but I believe it has a very beautiful message, and that's the message that I want to share with you. We know that in the Parsha, at Chet Egel, there's a major transition that's going to impact generations of Jewish life. And that is that up until this point, who was designated to be serving in the Beis HaMikdash? It was the?
Bechorim.
The Bechorim was the firstborns. But because the firstborns participated in the Chet Egel, and who did not?
Levim.
So Hashem pulls a switcheroo. And he says, the Levim, from now on, you're going to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. And the Bechor, you've lost that privilege because you participated in Chet Egel. As for Aaron Cutler, hold on a second. I understand why the Bechorim lost the right. They actively did something wrong. But what made Shevet Levi worthy of it? He says at the end of the day, they didn't actually do anything. They just didn't do something.
Shevet
Al Tase. So he says, that's not so impressive. In other words, if you told me that they performed a big mitzvah, okay, I understand. All they did really was hold themselves back from an action. That wouldn't exactly cause us to celebrate them. It means they're not going to get punished, but that's like the biggest deal in the world that for the rest of history, they're now going to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. How exactly, mechanically, does that work? So he develops an idea. And the idea is on the bottom of page number five, based on a Gemara in Yerushalmi. The Gemara in Yerushalmi says, quotes from Shimon Bar Yochai, if you see that the Jewish people are weakening their hands in Torah, so you should be the one to strengthen them in Torah. And if you do, you receive the reward for everybody. Okay, so let's take an example that there are $100 of reward. So if I am mechazik everyone to learning Torah, so I get the schar for everybody. I get the whole $100. Why? So presumably you would say,
because of you.
Because of me. Because it was me who inspired them. Therefore, I should get it. But then if you turn the page, he quotes another. It goes on to say, right on the top of page number six, Zacha tzadik natel chelko v'chelek chaveiro ben Gan Eden. A tzadik doesn't just get his reward in Gan Eden, but he gets the reward of the people around him. Similarly, a Rasha who does a sin, he gets the punishment and the punishment of his friends. So that's Aaron Cutler. Again, mechanically, how does that work? Why is it that I should get the schar for someone else? Why is it that I should get the punishment for someone else? How does that work from a mechanical perspective? He says, you see this also to Rashi. When Yoshua and Kaleb ben Yefune, when they are battling the Meraglim, and they're the ones who don't succumb to saying Lashon Hara about Eretz Yisrael, Rashi says, Ella, milamed shenatlu chelkam shel Meraglim ba'aretz, that Kaleb and Yoshua, they received the portion of the Meraglim in the land of Israel. Again, how does that work out? So he asks in the second paragraph, Ubir adavar denotel hazoche began eden chelko shel habilti zoche. It means that I receive the word for someone who does it, who's not deserving. Why? So he says, perhaps there are two reasons. One is maybe it's because I get the schar because I had a bigger nisayon. In other words, let's just say theoretically that I'm surrounded by 99 rishayim, 99 wicked people. And I'm the one who keeps Torah and mitzvahs. So why do I get the schar for all the other 99? Why do I get the whole $100? Because it was much harder for me to keep a life of Torah and mitzvahs with bad influences all around me. And so because the nisayon, the test was harder for me, therefore the reward should be bigger than me. That's, I think, pashup shot, says Ravar. But then he offers a second suggestion. And his second suggestion says the following, essentially. He says there is essentially a certain amount of schar to go around at any time of the day. Right? Hashem created Torah and Avodas Hashem. And he says, again, let's just use our analogy. There's $100 to be made of schar, of Torah and Avodas Hashem. Which means that if 100 people all keep Torah and mitzvahs at the same time, how much do each of us get?
$1.
Each of us gets a dollar. But let's say 99 people don't keep Torah and mitzvahs. And I am the only one that keeps Torah and mitzvahs. Says Aaron Cutler, a mind-boggling idea. It means that because I'm the only one doing it, you know what I get? I get the schar for all of them. So it's not necessarily that I'm getting more schar because I had a bigger nisayon. It means that there's a pot. And that, right, you know, think about it. Think about like a lottery, right? A split the pot lottery. So if there's $1,000 in the lottery and 10 people are in the lottery, so my chances of winning are pretty high. If there's $1,000 in the lottery and there are 1,000 people entering the lottery, my chances have gone down significantly to win the lottery. Says Ravon Carlo, that's how schar works in the world. At any moment in the world, there's a certain pot of schar to go around. There's a certain pot of reward to go around. The more people that are keeping Torah and mitzvahs, that's split in more different ways. The fewer people, it just means that the people that are keeping it actually get more. Now, why do I think this is a beautiful idea? You're probably saying Moskowitz, like what's the big deal? First of all, let's tie it back into the Levium. He says, now you understand why the Levium got so much schar. Because it wasn't just that they didn't participate in the Avera, but it was that everyone else was. And so because they were the few, they were able to take more of the reward at the time, and therefore their reward in perpetuity. That's how he answers the question. Why do I love this idea? I love this idea, and this is what Aaron Cutler does with this idea. He says, this should highlight for us the power of learning Torah and keeping mitzvahs at times when other people are not. In other words, there is a special skula, he writes, for learning Torah Friday afternoon. You know why? Because guess who's learning Torah Friday afternoon? Very few people. There's a special skula, he writes, for learning Torah Friday night. You know why? Because most people are passed out with saliva dripping down their mouths on Friday night, right? There's a special skula for learning Shabbos afternoon. You know why? Because again, most of us have a book smashed into our face on Shabbos afternoon. There's a special school, he writes, learning Motzei Shabbos. Because most people are at the movies or whatever. He says, if you are able to maximize and find the times when everybody else isn't learning Torah, he says there's a special skula for receiving reward specifically during those times. By the way, it doesn't just apply to Torah learning. When is the biggest nisayon for anger during the week? Friday. Biggest test of anger. Friday afternoon, Erev Shabbos. Never happens in my house, right, Moshe? Our house is peaceful and tranquil. We're actually ready in our house. You can ask Moshe, we're ready like 6 hours before Shabbos. We're playing games with each other. Moshe and I have a 3-hour Seder on Friday afternoons. Everyone's just happy and dancing and smiling. No, I'm just joking. Right? Friday afternoon, there is a special school in every Jewish home in the world to get angry at each other. Spouses are angry at each other, parents are angry at children. That's just the way it goes. It's a chaotic time. Says Ravon Cutler, if you're able to control your anger at that time, it's a bigger skula. You're able to get more of the pot of that. So it's dafka, he says, finding the times when it's more challenging to do and everyone else therefore abandons it. If you can maximize those times, you're going to elevate yourself that much more. You're going to find more schar and you're going to get more siyata d'shmaya in those times when nobody else is doing it. And so that's the encouragement that he gives us. The encouragement he gives us is to push ourselves specifically to find times when it's more difficult, when it's harder for other people. And if we can learn and maximize those opportunities, then the reward is going to be that much greater for us. And that was the reward that Shevet Levi had. Because when others weren't doing the right thing, they got the schar, not just for themselves, but for everyone else around them. And that was the big schar that Shevet Levi got that propelled them to be able to serve in the Beis HaMikdash in perpetuity. Think about the impact that that had. That is Rav Aaron Cutler. So we saw three ideas in 30 minutes. Idea number one came from the Bina Elitim, and that is the challenge to remain fresh, to keep the spark alive. Moshe Rabbeinu taught us that important lesson by putting the mask on his face so that they wouldn't always be exposed to the light. Idea number two came from Rav Weinfeld, and that is Judaism is not now or never, and it's not all or nothing, but rather change is gradual, it's steady, it's incremental, it happens in stages, and it is a progress. It's not going to happen overnight, and it's never going to achieve perfection. We have to continue to drive that into ourselves. And Rav Aaron Cutler, Mishnah's Rav Aaron, how do you understand the big schar of the Levium? He says it's dafka, if we're able to maximize the times when nobody else is doing it, or when everyone else is falling prey to a specific sin, if we're able to strengthen ourselves in those moments, then the reward for us is that much greater. That should be mechazik us, that should strengthen us and inspire us to learn at times when we otherwise wouldn't learn. Is it Erev Shabbos? Is it Friday night? Is it Shabbos morning? Is it Shabbos afternoon? Is it Saturday night? To not get angry Erev Shabbos. Take those opportunities when the test is harder and everyone else is failing. If you're able to overcome it, says Ron Carlo, the schar is that much greater. And with that, I wish everyone a good Shabbos.